So first, we will welcome Dr. Akeem Doberman, Director and Chief Executive of Rothamsted Research in the UK. Dr. Doberman is a distinguished international agronomist and soil scientist, having previously worked with the International Rice Research Institute, as well as the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He's involved with sustainable intensification activities in Europe and internationally, particularly through his role as co-chair of the Sustainable Agriculture and Food Systems Group of the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, a United Nations program supporting the post-2015 sustainable development process. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Doberman to the stage.
Yeah, good morning. It's great to be here. I think the last time I've been at the ASA meeting was 7 years ago. I'm hoping to catch up with lots of people. And I see quite a few of them in the audience already, so great to see you guys. Sustainable intensification is a buzzword. I mean, nobody really has a clue what it really means, you know, so all I can do is give you my opinion, and I'm sure that the other speakers will have perhaps a different opinion on it. You know, so, but in science, we have a tendency to create new buzzwords because it also makes it easier to win money for the research we do. You know, so when you do a literature search for terms like sustainable intensification or ecological intensification, blah, 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 you see that kind of picture. I took the number scale out there on the left because depending on where you search, you get different numbers. But let's say nowadays, every year, a couple of hundreds of papers are written on sustainable intensification. It's a recent phenomenon, as you can see, really just kicking in the last 6, 7, 8 years. You know. In the early 1990s, or late 1990s, I would say, we had other terms that we would use. Colleagues in France would call it ecological intensification. My colleague Ken Kassmann wrote a paper in 1999 calling ecological intensification. Then in the subsequent years, people talked about eco-efficient agriculture in Australia or at SEAD. Now all of a sudden it became sustainable intensification. Don't ask me what the difference between these things is. I don't know. All I know is that it is a debate which is largely led by people in the academic circles of the rich countries. So you can see by far the vast majority of papers from the UK, from the US, France, Netherlands, that's Wageningen. So relatively few in Kenya, that's a cluster of CG centers. So the term is not even easily translatable into many languages. I think our Chinese colleagues are struggling with it to find a word in the Chinese language to actually express it. You know. But we've come up with it. It's good for us. It makes us publish papers and win grants. But we also need to make sure that we can do something with it. This is one of the most recent papers, and I want to read you the sentence in full length. The criteria and approach we propose for a paradigm shift towards sustainable intensification of agriculture integrates the dual and interdependent goals of using sustainable practices to meet rising human needs while contributing to resilience and sustainability of landscapes, the biosphere, and the earth system. I'm out of breath. There's nothing wrong with this, you know, and it's a great paper, and I know many of the authors, you know. But let's get real. If we speak this language, nobody has a clue what on earth we are talking about and how we are going to achieve it. Yeah? Yeah, so my talk is about, well, I can bring it down to some simple doable things, and I'm going to do that largely by showing three examples. So when you write your next papers, please keep that in mind. Make sentences, not crossing 5 lines or half of your entire paragraph for the abstract. Yeah. So my very, very simple definition of sustainable intensification is it is to increase food production from existing farmland while minimizing pressure on the environment. I can explain that. I can understand that. I can probably also explain that to a high school kid or somebody else or a politician. You know. If I add much more to this, people will struggle. You know. It is largely an intellectual concept in my view, so it's a framework that could guide specific action. You know. And interventions can take at very different scales. You know. So on a national scale, essentially we talk about the entire food system and what can be done there. On a landscape scale, we have to very much look at the wider range of ecosystem services, with agriculture being one part of that. And at a farm scale, it's largely about the good management of crop and livestock systems. That's what it's all about. That's where the bulk of the action takes place. And that's where also then I think technologies come in, whereas in the other skills it's very much about political goals and policies and also behavior change that needs to come in. So in the end it comes down to, particularly at the farm scale, but also at other scales, to really have practical, flexible, tailored solutions, because in the real world, farmers in particular are at different places with regard to their resource endowment and market access. These are the two axes that, in my view, primarily determine what you can do and what you cannot do, but also what you should do. Yeah. So, of course, we wanted to move all of these farmers ultimately to the green space, you know, to have excellent resource endowment and beautiful soils and access to everything, but also then market access that allows them to have access to the best knowledge, but also tied into value chains that return enough for them to make a decent living and actually be able to back invest that money into a better management of the natural capital. You know? So that's where we want to go, but most of the farmers in this world, or many of them, are somewhere in this space. In Africa, for example, most of them are stuck in the red zone. Yeah. So that's a simple framework. When IRI wrote its strategic plan for the period 2007 to 2015, in 2006, it created a graph like this. I modified it a few years ago a little bit to bring in sort of the new sustainable intensification thinking, but only a few words have changed. But the point was made that if we want to put achieve different goals in terms of productivity, income, resilience, and environmental outcomes, particularly in smallholder farming in this world, the entry point, the key entry point, is you must be able to raise system-level productivity and efficiency and resilience also, and access to this value chain. If you do that, then gaining more profitability and income will enable you to diversify and further accelerate your income generation, but also then make investments in more sustainable practices that then again have a benefit for productivity. So this is what was called the virtuous circle, whereas at the moment many farmers are stuck in a vicious circle. They are basically ruining their land because they have no other means to actually do better. It's not their fault. It's not that they want to do this. Yeah. It's essentially they're stuck in a cycle, in a circle, and we have to get them out of this and essentially enter into this kind of circle. Yeah. I think it is very important also, if you want to put sustainable intensification into practice, to have some clear metrics and also some clear targets, quantitative targets. What are we actually aiming for, you know? So this is just an example that I once put together for rice, you know. Well, you know, we'd like to have profitable rotations. We want to achieve on a consistent basis 80% or more of the yield potential or attainable yield, depending on how you define it. High yield stability, very high water efficiency. We think that we can achieve more than 60% nitrogen use efficiency. Yeah. And all of these other things. So that list, of course, will differ a little bit in terms of what your system is and what your priorities are. But my general advice is keep it straightforward. Keep it to less than 10, maybe even only 5. But then pay more attention to specifying clear quantitative targets, things that are actually aspirational but also can be achieved based on what we know. Yeah. So if you have fuzzy targets or fuzzy indicators that you can't measure, or you don't know how to get there, or you don't even know what they mean, nobody can actually use them to do something in action. Yeah. So I like to have things that are straightforward and measurable and actionable. So let's talk about three examples. I'm going to start at the national scale, the food system scale. So China, whatever China does, affects everyone in the world because it accounts for such a massive amount of the global resource footprint associated with food consumption, yeah, and energy consumption, just about anything else, yeah, and material consumption. Just as a side note, for those of you who like this kind of numbers, if the global economy continues to grow at the rate it has been growing in recent years, it doubles the global domestic product or global GDP, it will double in every generation, every 18 years. It's purely because of material consumption and population growth. And China obviously is a massive driver for that, and the Chinese government has recognized this problem. Yeah? So this is the new Agricultural Sustainable Development Plan, which was published last year. And what's most important is all of the major ministries in China have signed on to this, and most importantly, the Ministry of Finance. That's where the money is. So they've decided, okay, we've got the five goals: productivity, protect our land better, increasing water efficiency, pollution mitigation, and for the first time in Chinese history, at least in modern history, increasing the ecological functions of the country. So that also then has led to an ambition to create ecosystem function conservation areas, where you have specific major priorities, so water supply in the green areas here, soil retention in those, soil, not quite here, biodiversity conservation here. So you can sort of divide up the priorities in your country. Yeah? So the question is now, at the national scale, is it feasible to achieve all of these things, and what are the trade-offs? So we did a little exercise with colleagues in China. It's hopefully going to be published soon, on pathways for sustainable food production and consumption in China. So we had a model, the new form model originating out of Wageningen, that was essentially modeling the entire food system of China, all commodities, if you wish. And we used that to explore a number of scenarios. So the first scenario, this is where we are at present in China. This is a production frontier function, if you wish. But relating food self-sufficiency against environmental quality. And we're down here, So our goal is for China to maintain a relatively high level of food self-sufficiency, because it's simply too big. It cannot import most of its food. Then the world would go into big trouble, So it must have that high level, but it wants to go up that ladder, And it also wants to restrict the input use, because it's already using too much land, water, fertilizer, and so on, and chemicals. So it doesn't want to go that direction. It wants to go that direction in terms of the efficiency of these things. So the biggest jump in that particular exercise is through production-enhancing technologies. You can see that here. If we were also able to convince Chinese consumers to eat healthier and not follow the American and European paths and eating burgers and God knows what, but just follow the recommended Chinese diet, not even whatever, so that could make another major step, And of course, China has a policy option. It could say, what the heck, we've got enough money, we'll just import more food. Which of course helps them in terms of further improving their environmental footprint in China. But it reduces this, and it exports the environmental problem to other countries. So that's a policy choice. But this is a pathway. And you can see, in theory, it is possible to get from this very low level of inefficiency and environmental problems and qualities to a much higher level, while also achieving food security and much better input or efficiency use. So, but it requires, at the national scale, interventions at various levels. Let's take another example. Uruguay is one of my favorite countries for a variety of reasons. Also because it's got beautiful beef, So, which is, of course, not very healthy, we've been told. But once in a while, you can have a piece. It's okay. But Uruguay says we want to be a green country, but we also need to be competitive. There are no subsidies in that country. So they are already feeding about 30 million people with exports in the world. There are only 3.5 million itself in Uruguay. They say, based on the land resources that we have, we can feed probably 50 million people while also maintaining that green image. It's really cool. That's a goal. That's another kind of sustainable intensification goal. And Cameron, who's sitting here, did an exercise which was published in Global Food Security earlier this year, on the rice sector, where we have seen already a huge amount of progress. So you have an export-oriented sector, commercial rice farms, 200,000 hectares, beautiful rice pasture rotation, very sustainable, no subsidies. And in the last 20 years, it had a major success in terms of tripling its yield growth rates. Used to hover around at 40, 50 kilos. There was a period of flat yields. And then you can see, particularly in the last, let's say, 10 years or so, they went up from 5 tons per hectare to 8 tons on average now. And there are a number of technology changes that enhance that. So some new varieties, more intensive rotations, but a lot of it was actually the more systematic implementation of better agronomic practices, just about 6 different kind of practices, from the right kind of planting date and to earlier irrigation and better nitrogen management and things like that, just agronomy. So when Cameron did this analysis with the colleagues in Uruguay for that 20-year period from 93 to 2013, so you can see 3 lines here in the usual sort of spider diagrams at the beginning of the period, in the middle, and at the end. So you can see things have moved in the right direction. So yields have gone up substantially. Energy consumption has gone down also because there's been a shift from diesel pumps to electricity-powered pumps. Net energy yield of production went up by over 50%. Carbon footprint as a whole, yield scale improved by 30%. Water use efficiency went up by 40%. So these are significant achievements from an ecological intensification point of view on a scale of 200,000 hectares, if you wish. That's not small, There are, of course, new problems. To get there, there was an increase in nitrogen fertilizer rate because you need to get yields up. So in certain seasons, that also increases the risk of more nitrogen losses or also more agrochemical losses. So new risks are coming up. And there are also some other key performance indicators that we would probably like to look at but don't have the data yet. Biodiversity-related things, for example. But that's an example for, I think, ecological intensification or sustainable intensification that has already happened. And I think you could do a similar exercise for rice production in California, for example, and a few other systems in the world. And my last example is from Britain, where I live now. The problem we have in Britain is we are not quite sure what kind of agriculture we want. And we have fallen behind. So the Economist published a paper last year basically concluding, well, Britain, to total factor productivity growth, which is efficiency growth, has been much less than in many other countries in the world in the last 25 years or so. And the Economist, in his usual way, summed it up, agriculture in Britain is green, pleasant, but inefficient. Now, how are we going to keep that kind of agriculture alive? If it's green and pleasant, I like to run around and walk my dog in the nice English countryside, but farmers need to make a living. They're great stewards of the land and they are getting paid for it, but will society want to do this in the future? There are farmers who are way ahead of the curve already, and here's one of them, Paul Hovison, who as a young man came from Denmark to took over as an agronomist the management of a big estate, one of these dukes or whatever. It's not important. It's Saleh Farms. You can go there. But you can see their crop performance, and this is winter wheat, but they have the same kind of trend for other crops they go, is going up in terms of yield. Whereas the rest of the country, both at the national and regional scale, has had stagnating wheat yields for the last 20 years, and that's pretty much common all over Western Europe. In this farm, they've gone up from 9 to 11 tons. And you can see the same for barley, for sugar beets, and other stuff, So what are these guys doing differently? Well, they have a philosophy that the most important thing is to have a fantastic crop rotation. They're using a 7-crop rotation. And every operation, in this case, in particular the soil tillage system, is fine-tuned to the needs of the individual crop because they believe the most important thing is to get the soil structure right for each crop and over the longer term. So they don't call this soil quality or whatever else, they just say soil structure. But they fine-tuned it, and then also other things that are part of the production system to essentially manage a 7-crop rotation, which is very rare nowadays. Most farmers in the UK have gone to wheat, oilseed, rape rotations. Very few are producing these kind of rotations. In their case, that rotation and the principles for this farming were established by the Cook of Norfolk in the mid-19th century, at the end of the first industrial revolution. It hasn't changed since then. What they've done since then is fine-tune it, learn by doing, measure things, bought new machinery that they can do things more precisely. They're using essentially precision farming technology, but the philosophy of farming has remained the same. And then in recent decades, they have added the environmental features to that. That's Paul. You know. And every field now has wildlife strips around it, so hedges and flowering seed mixtures for birds, beneficial insects, and all that kind of stuff. That's become standard part of their practice. So now that is because these people have a long-term view, a philosophy. They didn't call it sustainable intensification, but we would probably call it that way. And their performance is great. You know. So what we now need to do in Britain is, can we maybe listen to these kind of people when we set the goals for our new agricultural strategy? The ministry wanted to issue a new 25-year food and farming plan earlier this year, when then the Brexit came, and they put it on hold. And they now need to rethink, okay, what is it actually that we need to do in this post-Brexit world? You know, and it's a great opportunity for our scientists also hopefully to contribute to that thinking. So hopefully we can make this contribution. But this was their initial idea of what the priorities were. It was all about marketing and consumers, you know, and productivity. So it wasn't, as I would call it, what I would like to see, a more holistic framework, but that's also more pragmatic in meeting these different goals. So for me, the most important thing in this whole SI discussion is that we need to have a picture of a successful outcome in mind. I've got this thing framed in my office. I look at it every day with everything I do. Just try to keep thinking, okay, what do you actually want to achieve, you know? Yeah. Because you can get lost in this complexity. You know? So this is from the Montpellier panel, you know, what they see as sustainable intensification. So it's again the intensification process here and the technology components that we can do to achieve outcomes. But there's this whole enabling framework that needs to be addressed to actually be able to do it. It's really, really difficult, you know, particularly when you talk about smallholder farming in Africa. So you know, every one of these things needs to be achieved, you know. But, and that's my last slide, if we can come back to just keeping things simple, and I would call this often just good agronomy as a basis, you know, we can probably achieve a lot. So Elon Musk a few weeks ago unveiled his vision for the house of the future. So it would have solar roof tiles, which feed the house, but also have a power wall here to store the electricity and batteries, and you can plug in your car. That is simple, it is integrated, it is transformative, and it is really cool. So why can't we do something like that in agriculture? I want to have a house like this. Thank you.